Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We've decided to juggle our guests a bit here in the first part of this hour and speak first with Kathy Cleaver, Director of Planning and Information for the Pro-Life Secretariat of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. You probably read in the paper, if you were paying attention, that the Vatican had issued a series of guidelines for Roman Catholic politicians. What exactly do these guidelines call for? Are they new? And, well, what are the chances that prominent Roman Catholic politicians, especially those who are pro-choice, are going to abide by them? We'll find out about that in the first few minutes of this hour of Issues Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Kathy Cleaver, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
These are these new guidelines from the Vatican? What exactly are they calling for?
What we saw last week was a doctrinal note issued by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And it was, more than anything new, it really was a bringing together of many of the church's teaching documents on politics, really, and it was addressed to democracies primarily, and it called on politicians and lay people to a closer adherence to sanctity of life principles in political activity.
I noticed in the St. Louis paper here that the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Bishop of Belleville, Illinois, Wilton Gregory, had high praise for these guidelines. Is that the general consensus you would think among the bishops here in America?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to get a pulse on, you know, how bishops are reacting to something like this. But I think that it should be very warmly welcomed by the bishops and church officials. It's kind of a beautiful summary of the church's rejection of the notion of moral relativism, and the church comes out and says that to those who adhere to the proposition that a pluralistic society has to kind of embrace moral relativism, those people are wrong, and that all opinions are not of equal value, and that even in democracies, there is a need to look to moral truths, especially truths about the sanctity of human life. So it was a kind of a very strong denunciation of moral relativism, and that is, you know, sorely needed today. And the other thing that it did, really, that I perceived as sort of new, was an attack on this principle of secular intolerance. What the document talks about is that Catholic lay people and Catholic politicians who want to bring Catholic views on things like human life into the political arena have been discriminated against. Have been told that these are religious views and they have no place in sort of public policy debates. And so this Vatican document is saying that is an utterly false approach, and that these Catholic views reflect truths about the nature of the human person, and they are not only appropriate, but they are fundamental to public policy, and so they cannot be discriminated against.
Now, the paper, the article that carried this story is also, in its body, has the response of several local politicians here in the St. Louis area, I won't name names, who are, by their admission, devout Roman Catholics, but who say they don't really feel the need to be guided by the Vatican or by church documents with regard to their decisions. Most of them are saying that, you know, I am pro-choice, and I do that out of a clear conscience. Even as a Roman Catholic, I don't believe everything that the church puts out, and I'm pretty much going to vote and act the way I've been elected to vote and act. Your response?
The document, in very sort of Italian church phraseology, said that it is completely wrong to take the position that I am personally opposed, but, you know, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I'm going to be a good politician and I'm going to consider everybody's views equally. So it addressed that issue, the issue about politicians saying, well, you know, I may have certain views, but I can't impose them on other people. And it said that is utterly wrong. But I think what you're getting at is a kind of even a further step away from church teaching and saying that, you know, I'm just not going to take any guidance from the church. This document, as all documents, I mean, especially the Pope's encyclical Evangelium Vitae and other documents, have talked about what true Catholic faith means when it comes to sanctity of life and the political approach to issues about defending life. And it's not obscure, you know, it's not confusing. The church has been very, very clear about the issue of protecting life in the beginnings of life, when countries decide whether or not they're going to legalize something like abortion, and at the very end of life. So Catholic politicians and Catholic lay people that step away from these clear guidelines, step away from the church's teachings, do so as an act of protest. I think it is proper to consider politicians and lay people who turn away from the church's teaching as outwardly protesting against the church. So you can't in one sentence say, yes, I'm being faithful to the church and protest against the church on an issue like this.
So in a way, it does draw, while it doesn't appear to have any binding force per se, like we're not talking about future excommunications, at least that's my impression of the document, its binding force is rather limited in that sense. It does draw a line in the sand saying, if you fall outside the church's teaching on these particular issues named here, you can consider yourself dissenting from the church's position and you cannot claim to be standing with the church.
I think that would be an appropriate interpretation. There will be, I dare say, other interpretations of this document, because I don't recall the word dissenting, and that may be a word that some people may think is loaded. I think that's an appropriate interpretation of this document. It is sort of a restatement of, and it draws on the different resources that the church has prepared for us and for the faithful to know what is our guiding light on issues like this, and it brings it all together. So I'm hoping that it'll be used, you know, as a resource, as a guide, I don't think it's presenting any new doctrine. I think that's pretty clear. But I do like the idea of this kind of fresh new attack on secular intolerance and this idea that we can't bring Catholic views on human life into the public square. So that is something that is that can be put to very positive use by Catholic politicians when their views are shut down by media and their opponents as, you know, not worthy of public debate because it's too Catholic or whatever. So that's going to be a good, that's something that's kind of new and fresh in this document.
Yeah, two things strike me about the document. One is the possibility that the timing might send a message. But the other thing is, and I want you to answer that just in a minute, mm-hmm. but the other thing is that this is, in a lot of ways, if one looks at the Roman Catholics in the context of the American church in general, including Protestants, of course,
mm-hmm.
This is the Roman Catholic Church bucking the trend. Most mainline Protestant denominations are going exactly in the opposite direction of these teachings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you've got to love this church. I mean, people who are not Catholics admire the church. It comes back and back and back again and says it and says it again and says it another way and says it again. I mean, the Catholic Church's voice on human life is the prophetic voice of our age. And so here we have, you know, everyone wonders about timing when documents like this come out. And, of course, these things are not written overnight. So this probably had some sort of preparation time of, well, you can only guess, maybe over a year or what have you. So it's hard to say, well, it came out this month for a reason, you know, because it's really probably been in the works for a very long time. But we know about the emergence of some of the biotechnology issues that threaten human life at its very beginning, such as human cloning. This document mentions respect for human embryos in particular. You know, maybe that was something that the Vatican thought we need to reiterate again here, as, you know, all of these sort of euphemistic and crazy arguments that are being made now that tend to try to draw people away from the fundamental truth of whether it's okay or not to intentionally kill a human embryo. So, it, you know, some speculate, well, maybe it's this human cloning debate that's bringing this document to the fore now. But the Church's witness on human life is absolutely beautiful and true, and you're right to say that it really bucks the tide.
There is an op-ed piece that appeared also in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in response to this, and it harkened back to the position that then Democratic presidential candidate John F. Kennedy took in 1960, in which he said, and the quote is here in the paper, "I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me." And in this way, he assuaged the concerns of many that the Pope would be running the United States if he were elected president, I have to put it crassly.
Mm-hmm.
And this op-ed piece accuses the Vatican in its most recent document here of turning back the clock.
Mm.
And it says, if every Roman Catholic politician and layperson voted and acted in their various capacities completely consistently with Roman Catholic teaching on moral issues, they say the result would be chaos and what they call a moral twister that would have this terrible inconsistency against abortion and against the death penalty and all these kinds of things. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, this document actually kind of takes on what the logical result would be of embracing moral relativism, and then what you would end up with if you embrace moral relativism as a sort of a, if society really embraces that. I mean, they're on their way. We're on our way here in this country. But you end up, what you do end up with then is anarchy. So this person who's opposing this document, I think, has it all wrong. And when you look at politicians, form their consciences somewhere, from some source, unless they are completely amoral, and those are not the kind of people I think anyone would want in office. And so where do we want our politicians to form their moral consciences? And why is it the case that a conscience formed in Catholic moral theology and belief that talks about, you know, universal truths about the human person that embraces natural law and so forth, why is that conscience in the soul of a politician any less sort of worthy of the office of a politician? I mean, this document takes that on, and takes it on very straightforwardly, and says these are public policy issues that our church reflects. It's part of our religion, but it's no less also a part of questions that the society has to address, in the whole arena of politics. So because it is politically important, and also religiously important, you know, those two things don't cancel each other out. I mean, you can have issues that have religious importance and political or social importance, and human life is one of those issues.
One last question for you, Kathy. I understand that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops recently released a statement, I think it's called Roe v. Wade, A Matter of the Heart. What is the nature of their statement there?
That statement was to mark the 30th anniversary of the sad occasion of Roe v. Wade. And the statement was passed by the full body of bishops, so it's a statement by the entire U.S. bishops. It states very firmly that Roe v. Wade must be overturned, but it also talks about the signs of hope that we can see over the last 30 years. Chief among them is this the influence of very young people in the pro-life movement, and how the movement is, and the cause of life is drawing and attracting so many young people. So the bishops are pointing to some concrete evidences that our culture really is turning away from abortion and turning toward a culture of life, perhaps ever so slowly, but that ultimately Roe v. Wade must be overturned.
Kathy Cleaver, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Oh, I'm most welcome.
Kathy Cleaver, Director of Planning and Information for the Pro-Life Secretariat of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. We've been talking about those Vatican guidelines for the Roman Catholic politicians and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops issuing a statement on the anniversary of 30 years of Roe v. Wade.
I am pro-values, pro-faith, pro-family, and pro-choice.
That was Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut. He's one of six Democratic presidential candidates running already now in 2003 for the 2004 spot in the White House. He spoke at an event last night sponsored by NARAL Pro-Choice America. Our guest for the next 10 minutes is Kristen Day. She's president of Democrats for Life based in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about last night's event, get her reaction, and after we're done talking with Kristen Day, get your reaction as well. We'll hear from some of the other presidential candidates, too. Our phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kristen Day, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show tonight. It's been a busy couple days here in Washington, D.C.
I'm sure it has. Did you have an opportunity to see the NARAL Pro-Choice America event as it was telecast?
Unfortunately, no. While they were telecasting the event, we had our whole board in town for Democrats for Life for America, so we were meeting, and we had a very successful lunch for pro-life Democrats at noon that day before our board meeting, and we had Ambassador Ray Flynn come and address the group, and it really motivated us and to keep the fight going.
You did see clips or highlights of the event, I understand. Your reaction in general to the fact that all six of the prospective candidates for president from the Democratic ticket not only go to this event and in essence kind of sing its praises, but sound one single note on the issue of abortion and of life, and that is the pro-choice note.
It is very disappointing that all six candidates are vying for this position as the most pro-abortion. It's just, especially when some of them were pro-life and have changed their views on the issue. And I think it is because of the control, I mean, the vast amounts of money and power that NARAL has supporting candidates for higher office. We see that in Congress we have a lot of pro-life Democrats, but when you move over to the Senate, there are very few because of the pressure they get, pro-life Democrats get when they start moving up to run for higher office.
Is NARAL Pro-Choice America and Planned Parenthood, are they really that important to the Democratic Party?
Unfortunately, they are. They have a lot of pull because they raise a lot of money and they get a lot of support from the pro-abortion members of Congress and those candidates that are running. They do raise a lot of money, and our job is to try to raise just as much money so we can support pro-life Democrats who would like to raise to higher office.
Explain two things to me, if you can. Mm-hmm. How is it that in the case of the local guy here is Representative Dick Gephardt, former Speaker of the not Speaker of the House, he wanted to be Speaker
right.
of the House.
Right, yes.
But Minority Leader. And he, at one time, was pro-life. First of all, how does that flip-flop take place in a candidate like this? And why do they seem inevitably to say, I've never changed my mind. I said I was pro-life and now I'm pro-choice, but I never really changed my mind.
Well, I think it starts, the pro-life Democrats, they have, they stand by the principles, most of them, but then when you get a candidate who wants to move up to a higher office, you really do need the support of the party, and you need the support of big donors to continue to move up in the party and up in the office. And unfortunately, that issue has taken over the Democratic Party, and they won't really support candidates who are pro-life. They encourage them to change their views, and then they'll get the support in exchange for the support from the party. We are hoping to change that, and we're trying to work with the DNC to show that, Democrat pro-lifers are out there. And we went to the March for Life today, and we were approached by so many people saying, oh, I didn't know you existed. I thought I was the only one. And it was just an amazing show of support for us. And also, these people, some of them are independent. Some of them switched their votes to Republican, but they do want to come back to the party, and they will come back to the party if we try to move away from being so pro-abortion.
Did the president, as planned, address via telephone the pro-life gathering there in Washington, D.C.? Did you have an opportunity to hear what he had to say?
Yes, it was. There were a lot of people out there, and so it was hard to hear. But yeah, we did. He did address the crowd, and had a pretty good reaction from the people out there.
Is it odd for you as a Democrat and your organization as Democrats to be looking to a president, a Republican president, like George W. Bush, for encouragement and hope at a time like this, especially on the 30th anniversary of Roe v. Wade?
It is. It is hard because we would like to see our party be the ones who are promoting, protecting people, we sometimes say, from womb to tomb, because that was our original mission, is we want to help people along their whole lives and trying, and making sure people have health care and their Social Security benefits and things like that. But we also think that the party should, protect the unborn, and it's a shame that they don't. But, you know, so we would like someday to have a pro-life president that we can be proud of and have that pro-life president be a Democrat.
Now, what would have to change in the structure of the Democratic, the National Democratic Party, for a politician not only to be able to rise through the ranks, but even be able to make a stab at the apple or a bite at the apple of the presidency and be pro-life?
I think we're starting the road to move toward that direction, I hope. And I think it's just we need to get active. The pro-life Democrat needs to be active on the local level, and we need to have our voices heard. I think a lot of pro-life Democrats stay in the closet because they're afraid to come out and say, I'm pro-life, because of the reaction they get from the party. A lot of times when I talk to a woman today who's a pro-life Democrat, and she went to her local county meeting and started talking about that issue and said she was pro-life, and they never invited her back and won't let her come back. And that's how the Democratic Party is losing members. So they have to realize that there's some way we got to get along.
Well, you know what?
we're supposed to be the party of the big tent, and so they need to bring those people back.
What strikes me as odd, Kristen, is that of the six men who were there at the NARAL Pro-Choice America event, those six men are going to be running against one another
right. In
about a year when the primaries roll around. They are going to be trying to find an issue by which to distinguish one another there. And it seems, at least at this point, they've all sung exactly the same tune on an issue that they think is important enough to highlight this way.
Right. And it is. Well, Gephardt did actually support the ban on partial birth abortion last year when it came up before the Congress. So that's what he does differ a little bit from some of the other members in that he did oppose partial birth abortion.
On the basis of that, would you be would anyone be leaning toward a Gephardt presidency?
No. We only support pro-life Democrats. Our organization only endorses and supports pro-life Democrats. So we are happy that he at least saw to it to vote support that, the partial birth abortion. But we'd like some of the members to come around a little bit more and support other issues, too.
Do you think it's possible that perhaps in the next decade or so, this is the last question, Kristen,
sure.
That one of these pro-choice Democrats might actually buck the trend and flip-flop back or to the pro-life position?
I'm hoping that they will, because you see around the country, you see people. I think the norm for a politician is to switch, in the Democratic Party, is to switch from being pro-life to pro-abortion. But I think when you look at the general population, people are more likely to switch from being pro-abortion to being pro-life. When they start looking at the, you know, if you saw the Time News article with the pictures in the womb, and when people start seeing that, and you can see the heartbeat, and you can see that, you know, what's the difference between a baby at, you know, 16 weeks versus 8 weeks. If the baby at 16 weeks is just a little bigger and maybe a little bit more developed, but there's not much difference. So I think people are beginning to see that and see that, you know, it is a baby. So I think in the general population, I think more people are more likely to switch to being pro-life, and we hope that we can convince some of the Democrats that that's the right way to move.
Kristen Day, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Kristen Day is president of Democrats for Life, based in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear what some of the six Democratic presidential candidates had to say at last night's NARAL Pro-Choice America event. We'll hear it from their own mouths. I will react a little bit, and your reaction as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues, Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues, etc.
Skin colors. How many are there?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the writers for Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, many people believe that there are a number of different skin colors. So, how many are there really?
Well, this may come as a shock to some people, but humans really only have one skin color. All humans, except albinos, have a pigment in their skin called melanin. Now, there are two forms of this pigment that give skin its color. People who are black have a lot of melanin, and those who are light only have a little of this pigment. Actually, the majority of people in the world are middle brown. Now, there are at least four genes for the amount of melanin in our skin. Thus, it would make sense that the first couple, Adam and Eve, were middle brown. The possible combination of genes from such parents could result in children ranging from black to very light in just one generation. In fact, there are many families like that in the world today. Then, because of the split up of the gene pool at the time of the Tower of Babel, different combinations of genes ended up in the various people groups. This resulted in the pigment distribution we see in various cultures today. Yes, the evidence fits with the Bible's account of history.
For more eye-opening information from the Bible and science on the origin of different people groups, read Ken Ham's free booklet on the origin of the so-called races. This fascinating booklet can be found at AnswersRadio.com. So next time you're on the web, read Ken Ham's free booklet on racism. It's at AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
Five 5:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Tonight's meeting of the Lay Bible Institute at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville has been canceled. Tonight's session will be made up on the evening of February 5th. Weather for St. Louis: partly cloudy tonight, very cold, low near zero. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, continued cold, high right around 15. Right now, overcast and 14 in St. Louis. Our last look at St. Louis traffic: westbound 40 jammed from Van Deventer to Hanley. Also heavy and slow McKnight to Lindbergh. Westbound 44 jammed approaching Eureka. Westbound 70 heavy and slow from Jennings Station through the Cool Valley. Taking a look at the bridges: westbound 5570 after 4th Street, slow traffic to the Poplar Street Bridge. Eastbound 40 at Grand Boulevard, stop and go traffic to the Poplar Street Bridge. And northbound 55 backed up on 44, headed for the Poplar Street Bridge. Up next, open lines on Issues, etc. The new St. Louis County Department of Parks and Recreation Scout, Youth, and Family Programs Guide is now available free of charge. The guide details dozens of programs that are available to scout and youth groups. Topics included in this year's guide are campouts, nature hikes, education, mountain man, fishing, alpine tower, ropes course, caving, ecology, and scout badge programs. To receive a free copy, call the St. Louis County Parks.
Welcome back. The last half hour of Issues, Etc. is open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll be hearing from some of those Democratic presidential candidates at last night's NARAL Pro-Choice America gathering. We'll hear it from their own mouths. I'll react. I'd like your reaction to the phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. But first, this morning I spent a few minutes down in Steelville, Illinois, doing a chapel for the children at St. Mark's Lutheran School down there. A big group of kids. I love talking to kids. I love children. I don't know why. I just do. They're sweet. They're cute. They're delightful. Well, you know, most of the time, you know what I'm talking about. As I was driving home, it's a long drive back, about an hour. As I was driving home, I was listening to the radio, and the only thing on the radio, no matter where you turn the dial except for music, was, of course, the issue of Roe v. Wade abortion and the pro-choice, pro-life perspectives. I listen for a while to one station, I get frustrated. Perhaps it's a pro-choice position being made, and I wish I could respond to some of the arguments, or a pro-life position being made that I think falls short. And I could not help but reflect on the fact that it seems that the Christian church is still largely silent. Not only silent on the issue of life, but silent, I think, for a reason other than just their courage with regard to the fifth commandment, you shall not kill. I think their courage has been bled away from them because they have forsaken what it is to be the Christian church. In other words, those things that are essential for Christians to believe. that maybe this silence on the part of the church when it comes to the issue of life is just a symptom of the church's silence when it comes to what Scripture teaches about everything. We at Issues Etc. have this book that we are promoting by way of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month. It's called The Essential Teachings of Christianity. We don't do it because we like simply promoting books. We do. We do it because these are essential. When we say essential, we don't mean just important, relatively important. We mean essential not only to the lives of Christians, to your family, to your congregation, but even for our lives together as a nation. When we have forsaken these teachings, then what else goes? You can get this book. It's called To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity, by calling tomorrow during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. That's the number of Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and there you will find a link to Concordia Publishing House where you can order the book. That you can do anytime, day or night, but tomorrow if you call during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, and ask to receive the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, they will send you To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. Now, I promised that we would hear from the presidential candidates on the Democratic side themselves. First, let's hear Congressman Dick Gephardt. He's expressing his regret for once being a pro-life congressman.
I came to realize that the question of choice is to be answered not by the state, but by the individual who wrestles with their uncertainties and reaches a decision that they can justify to their own God.
I find this interesting, that he felt at liberty to raise the issue of God and justifying one's decision before God. Surely Congressman Gephardt is aware of the fact that if the decision with which one wrestles turns out to be wrong, there will be no justifying that before God. I mean, after all, we are talking about either doing good or sinning. It sounds like he is making the argument, really, that a woman can't make a bad decision here, as long as she can justify it. But he was the one who raised the issue of God. And I would simply ask rhetorically, if to kill your unborn child is in fact what it appears to be, and that is murder, how will you justify that before God? Next, we hear from the Reverend himself, Al Sharpton. Last night at this NARAL Pro-Choice America event, Reverend Sharpton offered his thoughts on the religious right.
As I crossed, a young lady said to me, "Forget your political activism. You're a minister. And real Christians can't support that." And I said, "Young lady, it is time for the Christian right to meet the right Christians."
Or perhaps it's time for the Reverend Al Sharpton to meet Jesus. Now, Dick Gephardt is a politician. He's no clergyman. And in that sense, I guess one might say he's got an excuse. He could say, "I'm no theologian, I don't know my Bible." The Reverend Al Sharpton, at least ostensibly, should know these things and know better. And yet he seems to think that the right kind of Christians are the kind of Christians that can support abortion. It's interesting that the accusation that he takes so harshly from a pro-lifer, that Christians can't support this, he turns right around and says Christians who don't support it are the wrong kind of Christians. Let's hear again from Senator Joseph Lieberman. We heard from him a little bit in the last segment. Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, here's what he had to say.
"I am pro-values, pro-faith, pro-family, and pro-choice."
I will admit that Senator Lieberman does have a better speechwriter than the rest of these guys. Because it's all concise, it's all soundbite-ish. That sounds great. It's almost as good as Safe, Legal, and Rare. Because it seems to say, well, it's wrong, we know it's wrong, but we want it to be safe and legal and rare. It seems to concede, doesn't it? I'm pro-life, pro-values, pro-family. He didn't say pro-life. And pro-choice, he says. Let's see if we can unpack it. Pro-family, as long as that family doesn't include babies, if you don't want them. In other words, if you want your family just to be you and your husband, you and your boyfriend, you and your whatever, and there's an unwanted pregnancy, he's pro-family, so long as you make the right decision not to have the babies. I don't know, the last time I checked, the family still included children. But this is what happens to the basic meaning of words when one begins to twist even one meaning. Former Governor Howard Dean of Vermont alleged last night, this was interesting, I found this rather shocking, that some in the Bush administration have ignored violence at abortion clinics.
There are many good people who on moral grounds are opposed to abortion. I respect them. I do not respect the people who defend the throwing of bombs and murders of doctors, however, and some of those exist in our very administration. People who have not stood up against violence, they thought it would be better for their political careers if they didn't say too much about it.
Who is he talking about? I will give a little advice to Howard Dean. If he's really intent upon running for the presidency, if he's going to say things like that, he'd better be ready to name names when it comes time to sit on the same podium with George W. Bush. Who is he talking about? Someone in the administration who has advocated or allowed violence in the name of the pro-life movement. Maybe he was a little caught up in the moment. Who knows? He was getting a little applause there. Taking his words at face value, I agree with him. I have great respect for those who object to abortion on moral grounds. And I don't have that much respect for people who would advocate violence. In that sense, he's right. But to have respect for someone, I respect their moral position. Well, no, I'm sorry, let me put it this way. To say, I respect you, given your moral position, but I don't respect your moral position, is what he's really saying. Look, Mr. Dean, I don't care if you respect me. What I want you to respect is my moral position, that abortion is wrong, and it's killing babies. Here's Senator John Edwards of North Carolina on protecting a woman's right to choose.
She'll call on her own religious beliefs, her sense of right and wrong, and she'll make that decision. But the important thing is that that decision is hers, and it is hers alone.
I wonder if he would be willing to use the same line of argumentation, the same assertion, when it comes to any other act that might be considered more broadly immoral. Like, let's say, for instance, murder. It doesn't really make any difference what decision a person makes with regard to killing, say, their mother while she sleeps in bed, grandma while she's sleeping in bed, the next door neighbor because he's got a shiny red car, as long as it is their decision to make. I don't know what planet he is living on, but I don't know of any system of laws, any nation of laws, that would say, look, it doesn't make any difference what you decide as long as it's your decision. 150 years ago, I imagine that would have been a very convenient argument for the slaveholders to say, look, it doesn't make any difference whether you're pro-slavery or against slavery as long as each individual makes up. Wait a minute, they did make that argument, didn't they? Didn't the South make that argument? It doesn't. We don't care whether the North holds slaves. We're not going to force you to hold slaves. As long as it's my decision to make. Of course, they couched it under something called states' rights. I think the analogy is perfect. Again, along with Gephardt, seems to be saying that a woman cannot make a wrong choice when it comes to abortion. If she chooses to keep her baby, right choice. If she chooses to abort her baby, they're right choice. In other words, they are asserting that there is no wrong choice to be made here. Now you tell me this. If allowing your baby to live is in fact the opposite of killing your baby, how can both be right? But they say they are both right. I'm so glad, I speak sarcastically, that they're at least willing to say that keeping your baby is the right decision to make. Finally, this is the big fish in the pond. This is the guy who will probably give someone a run for their money. Senator John Kerry last night at this event sponsored by NARAL Pro-Choice of America, here's what he had to say.
Nothing we say here tonight diminishes or disrespects anybody's belief or sense of morality. On the contrary,
I think it respects America's fundamental fabric of justice and honors the notion that we don't impose our individual articles of faith on someone else.
This is the trick that is being pulled more often nowadays than I think before. Rather than simply disagreeing with someone on a moral or a philosophical basis, the trick that is being pulled by the pro-choicers is now to call opposition to abortion a religious article of faith, when in fact it is not. It is simply, in its bare bones, yes, it does have affinity with many religious articles of faith, and you don't have to be a Christian to hold that view, but in its bare bones, it is simply a very American thing to assert. And I need go no farther than the Constitution of the United States itself and the guaranteed right to life that is there explicitly for everyone, all men, everywhere. But he seems to say that it's a very un-American thing to do to try and impose this viewpoint, this respect for life, on anyone else. I wonder if the logic, again, extending this ad absurdum, I wonder if the logic would work in the case of someone who just sliced someone's throat in cold blood. Because my religious tenet would say, and my individual religious beliefs would say, that's a wrong thing to do. On what basis, then, could I possibly say that such a crime should be punished? According to Kerry, apparently, none whatsoever. I'd like to know what you think about this. If you had opportunity to see the NARAL pro-choice event, I'd like your response. And if you had opportunity here to hear some of these comments by the Democratic presidential hopefuls, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You didn't have to have seen it. Maybe you just heard what we played for you just now. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from Washington, Paul is on the line. Paul, welcome to Issues Etc.
Am I on the line?
You are.
First of all, I want to thank you for putting the truth out on the air, and we don't expect the truth from the politicians. I mean, that's really absurd. But the point I wanted to make is I would like to hear more Christian pastors on the air, on television, wherever it is, speak two things. The two passages come into my mind when I hear anything about homosexuality or women's choice for abortion or whatever. One of them is, be not deceived, God is not mocked. The most powerful thing ever is God's word. We know that, and all this talking and debating that the politicians do doesn't amount to one whip or whatever you want to call it. But the second and the most telling passage I like to that really fits here is, know ye not that your body is a temple of the Holy Ghost, which is in you, which ye have of God, and ye are not your own. Now, I believe that those messages spoken by Christian pastors or anybody is more powerful than all these arguments that they make.
Paul, thank you very much for the call. Let me respond to that, if I could. By way of proclaiming the general displeasure of God over this, the darkest mark that has ever appeared on a nation's history, 40 million dead babies in 30 years, do not be deceived, God is not mocked, is a great passage. God is not mocked. He will not be mocked. But I think there are better passages to appeal to as well. In general, I think I have to agree with what Paul has to say, and that is that when the ministers of the church, the pastors of the church, are given opportunity to speak publicly, I don't think they can remain silent. An historical perspective simply cinches the argument for me, and it's that analogy with the issue of slavery 150 years ago in this nation. We look back and deride those Christian ministers who simply said, well, you know, it's not an issue. It's not a big issue. Or those who said, what's happening here is not immoral. Now, there were Christian ministers who made the argument that slavery in and of itself could be permitted, but what was being practiced in our nation was an abuse of anything like that. we look back on the Christian ministers and the congregations in Nazi Germany in the early years when things were starting to turn sour, and we have nothing but condemnation for their silence. And I think history will judge Christian ministers, in particular, as teachers of the church and as evangelists of the church. And as I think one of our previous guests said, the prophetic voice of the church for remaining silent. What God will judge, we leave to God. What history will judge, I think that will pretty much come out in the wash. Al is calling from his car. Al, welcome to Issues Etc., and thank you for waiting.
Well, thank you for having me. You're extremely articulate. There are a couple of better analogies, I think, than the ones that you had, not necessarily better than slavery. But there is the analogy of other moral issues such as prostitution.
Lay it out for me. I'm interested. Lay that one out for me.
Well, it says that it's a woman's choice. It is a moral issue. Prostitution is against Christian and spiritual values. There are people who say it's victimless. And so how can you say that a woman has a right to choose whether or not her baby is going to live or die, but another woman does not have the right to choose what she does with her body? Because isn't that what they say? It's my body.
And, you know, I think the connection there is even more than just an analogy, because what we're really talking about in prostitution, as you well know, Al, as everybody knows, we're talking about how that woman exercises her quote-unquote reproductive freedom.
Absolutely.
In other words, she can have, and that's really the argument behind the Roe decision as well, a woman ought to have the privacy to engage in whatever kind of sexual activity she wants to, up to and including the conception of babies, with no consequences. Why? Because she ought to be able to keep the fact that she's been fooling around or whatever a secret by having an abortion. That was the explicit logic of Roe v. Wade. That's why they trounced out, or one might even say invented out of whole cloth, the right to privacy.
Another good example has to do, I think it may be Josh McDowell talks about positive and negative tolerance. And I wish I'd come up with some better terms, but what he calls positive tolerance, the tolerance that is being taught these days, says not only must you respect the person's right to have an opinion, but positive tolerance says that you must explicitly agree that that person's value judgment is as good and equally as valid as your own. And if you think that their value, their initial, whatever it is about what they do, is not equal to your own and equally valid, then you're being intolerant. When you look at that, how about the analogy of the Islam faith, where if you read the Hadith and you know what is in Islam, part of their faith, I mean, you talk about killing someone next door, which is kind of weak because that's a little different. But how about the Islam example, where they're explicitly taught within their system that it is absolutely okay to kill infidels, and in fact that's one of the best ways to guarantee going to heaven. That is a value judgment based on their religion. So how can we say that our values are better? And if a woman can kill her baby based on what her beliefs say, why is it wrong for someone from Islam to kill an infidel?
Al, I like the way you think. I like the way you think. And what we're really doing here is simply, by way of analogy, demonstrating the absurdity, the moral absurdity, the logical absurdity of the arguments being put forth by the pro-choice camp. 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Joe is calling from her car. Joe, thanks for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks for taking my call. I heard an interesting, or read an interesting article on Time.com today. They interviewed the lawyer that defended Roe. And I thought it was interesting the whole time she's talking about how she was so passionate about defending Roe's right to have an abortion. But then the interviewer asked her what she thought about Roe 25 years after having the abortion changing to pro-life. And she made the comment, this is obviously taken out of context, that it's more of a class action lawsuit, and she hasn't spoken to Roe since Roe became pro-life. It just seemed kind of odd.
Thank you very much, Joe. You know, the interesting thing is, and if you guys listen on Friday to the program, I'll tell you about that in just a second. If you listen to Friday on the program, you will hear some very interesting history from former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese on the nature of the Roe case and what it was and how it was not what it first appeared to be. It was not a rape case. It was later discovered that it wasn't. And that in many ways, the Roe decision, not only in its logic, but also in the case that was brought, was a multifold lie. You'll have to listen Friday. I'll tell you about that program in just a second. Let's see if we can get William in here. He's calling from Jennings. William, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, Todd, I wanted to, since I don't have much time, ask you to look at Joseph Farah, F-A-R-A-H, column on the World Net Daily on the web about the Catholics and what they said.
What exactly? Give me a very quick summary here.
Well, basically, he said, what price do Catholic politicians pay for taking heretical positions? None. In fact, even worse, there is no penalty for church leaders who embrace these politicians. And he gives a perfect example of Gray Davis, the incumbent who supported abortion on demand, and he won the race because of all the Democrats that voted for him, and even his pastor of his congregation was behind him.
Thank you very much, William. I appreciate the call. I'll take a look at that column, and perhaps I'll have opportunity to share it with the listeners of Issues, Etc. From a political standpoint, I think the Democratic presidential candidates are painting themselves into a corner. They will have to run against one another pretty soon, and they're all sounding the same note on this. The only person who will speak a word of dissent, if this is the slate of candidates who come up to the primaries, will be the Republican candidate, George W. Bush, if he decides to run again. The only alternative to a monolithic view that children ought to be legally exterminated in the womb. They're defending 30 years of abortion. With every year, they have to defend another year of abortion, another year of babies being killed. Maybe time is against them. I know that our conscience, our national conscience, our individual consciences eventually get calloused on this. That's the job of the pro-choice, pro-life community, is to keep the conscience keen. But maybe time is against them. Maybe after 35 years, it'll be harder to defend that many more killed. But that's what they're doing. Make no mistake about it. Friday on the program, we will talk about 30 years of decriminalized abortion in America with former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese, Judge Robert Bork, Senator Rick Santorum, Senator Sam Brownback, Sarah Foster of Feminists for Life, Father Richard John Newhouse, syndicated columnist Cal Thomas, and Dr. James Lamb. That's Friday on Issues, Etc. It's a program you do not want to miss, if only for that insight from former U.S. Attorney General Meese. But the insights of all the others will benefit you as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk to you tomorrow on Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Today's Issues, Etc. broadcast was underwritten in part by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January, To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, To All Eternity.